All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a look at a case that you, the listener, sent to us. And it's a really interesting one. It's Hamilton v. Schriro. And it gets into the whole issue of religious freedom, but specifically how that plays out inside a prison, which obviously creates some unique challenges. So that's our mission today, breaking down this case and trying to really get to the core issues.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this case really highlights the tension that can sometimes exist between protecting individual rights, particularly when it comes to religious practice, and the need for security and order, which in a prison environment are paramount, right? You've got to keep things running smoothly and safely. So it's a great case to really dive into those issues.
For sure. So just to give everyone a little background, this case is about Mark Hamilton, a Native American inmate who was serving time in a Missouri prison. And he basically filed suit because he was being denied the right to practice certain aspects of his religion.
Right. And those practices were specifically the right to participate in sweat lodge ceremonies, which, you know, are really central to many Native American traditions. And also, the prison had a policy about hair length that directly conflicted with his beliefs, where long hair holds a very significant spiritual meaning.
Okay, so right away, we're dealing with some pretty fundamental stuff. I mean, this isn't just about, you know, some minor inconvenience. It's about core religious practices that Hamilton was being prevented from engaging in.
Exactly. And that's where the First Amendment comes into play, right? The whole idea of the free exercise of religion. But on top of that, Hamilton's case was also based on the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is usually just called RFRA. And this law is really interesting because it basically sets a higher bar for the government when it comes to restricting religious practices.
Higher bar, what do you mean?
So basically, under RFRA, the government can't substantially burden a person's exercise of religion unless they can show that they have a really compelling reason, like a really, really good reason. And even then, the action that they take has to be the least restrictive way possible to achieve that goal. It's not enough to just have a decent reason. They've got to show that there's no other way to do it that would infringe less on someone's religious freedom.
Got it. So you've got Hamilton claiming that his First Amendment rights and this specific law, RFRA, are being violated by the prison's policies. So what happened when this first went to court?
Well, the case initially went to the district court, and in a bit of a surprise, they actually ruled in Hamilton's favor.
Really?
Yeah. They basically found that the prison's policies did impose a substantial burden on his religious exercise. And what's more, they said that the prison hadn't really shown that these restrictions were the absolute least restrictive way to achieve whatever goals they were trying to meet. So the district court actually ordered the prison to start accommodating Hamilton, including allowing him to participate in sweat lodge ceremonies every week, and they blocked the prison from enforcing their hair length rule on him.
Wow, so it sounds like, at least at that stage, it was a pretty clear win for Hamilton and for religious freedom in general.
It definitely looked that way. But of course, as with many legal cases, it doesn't always end there. The Missouri prison officials, you know, they weren't too happy with this decision, so they decided to appeal it to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. And that's where things got, well, a little more complicated.
More complicated how? What happened to the Eighth Circuit?
Well, the Eighth Circuit actually reversed the district court's decision. And that's what we really want to unpack today, you know. Why did they overturn that initial victory for Hamilton? What were their reasons?
Okay, so before we get into the reasoning behind the Eighth Circuit's decision, let's just make sure we're all clear on who exactly was involved in this whole legal battle. We know Mark Hamilton was the inmate who brought the lawsuit. Who is he up against?
Right. So on the other side, you had Schriro. And that wasn't an individual person. Schriro was essentially standing in for the Missouri Department of Corrections, representing the prison officials responsible for making and enforcing these policies. So it was really Hamilton, the individual inmate, versus the entire state prison system, which, you know, that's always going to be an uphill battle.
Absolutely. So to really understand the core of Hamilton's argument, we need to kind of go a little deeper into why these particular religious practices, the sweat lodge ceremony and the long hair, were so important to him. Why were they so central to his faith?
Right. So it's crucial to understand that these weren't just, you know, preferences or cultural habits. They were deeply intertwined with Hamilton's religious beliefs and practices. The sweat lodge, for instance, it's not just a sauna or a place to get clean. It's a deeply spiritual and communal ritual. You know, you've got intense heat, prayers, traditional songs, and it's all about purification, connecting with the creator. And it's a really, really central part of many Native American spiritual traditions. And then similarly with the long hair, You know, for many Native American cultures, long hair is seen as this tangible symbol of one's spirituality. It's a connection to the creator, to one's ancestors. It can be a sign of mourning or strength. And, you know, being forced to cut it is a deeply profound act that goes way beyond just physical appearance. It's seen as a real violation of their religious beliefs.
That makes sense. So for Hamilton, this wasn't just about personal style or anything like that. These practices were absolutely fundamental to his ability to practice his religion.
Precisely. And that's why this case was so significant. But of course, you also have to consider the prison's perspective, right? They had their own reasons for having these policies in place. So what were the prison's arguments for why these practices were a problem? What were their concerns?
Yeah, I'm really curious about that because on the surface, it seems like a pretty clear-cut case of religious freedom. But I'm sure the prison had some pretty strong arguments too, right?
Oh, they absolutely did. Their main arguments boiled down to safety and security, which, you know, in a prison environment, those are really, really big deals. So for instance, with the long hair, they argue that it could be used to conceal contraband. You know, think about it. You could hide drugs, weapons, little things like that in long hair, and it would be really hard for guards to detect. Plus, they also argue that long hair could be used by gang members for identification purposes, which could lead to, you know, violence or other problems within the prison.
So in their view, it wasn't about restricting religion. It was about maintaining a safe and secure environment for everyone. What about the sweat lodge ceremonies? What were their issues with those?
Right. So with the sweat lodge, their concerns were a little more multifaceted. One big issue they brought up was the lack of direct supervision. You know, sweat lodges are often built in these kind of enclosed structures, and the prison was worried that these ceremonies could create opportunities for inmates to engage in, you know, illicit activities, things like assaults, drug use, maybe even escape attempts, things that are harder to control when you don't have direct line of sight on everyone at all times. Plus, there were also concerns about the logistical challenges of accommodating these ceremonies. You know, sweat lodges need special facilities. They might require additional security personnel. And all of that can get pretty costly, which is always a consideration for prisons, which often operate on, you know, pretty tight budgets.
Right. So it sounds like they were trying to balance these security concerns with the need to respect religious freedom. And we know the district court initially sided with Hamilton, finding that the prison hadn't really shown that their restrictions were absolutely necessary. But then the Eighth Circuit comes along and reverses that decision. So what was their thinking? What led to that change?
Well, a really key factor in the Eighth Circuit's decision was this legal principle called deference to prison administrators' expertise. Basically, what this means is that courts are generally hesitant to second-guess the decisions of prison officials when it comes to matters of internal security and maintaining order. The idea is that prison officials are the ones on the ground dealing with these issues day in and day out. So they're in the best position to assess risks and figure out what policies are necessary to keep things safe and running smoothly. So unless there's really clear evidence that the prison's policies are just arbitrary or discriminatory, courts tend to give them the benefit of the doubt.
That makes sense, I guess. Prisons are such unique environments. It's probably hard for judges who've never worked in one to fully grasp all the nuances of what it takes to maintain order and security.
Exactly. And the Eighth Circuit really emphasized this point. They basically said that the district court had not given enough weight to the professional judgment of the prison officials. So even though RFRA sets a high bar for restricting religious practice, this idea of deference meant that the court was more inclined to accept the prison's arguments about security concerns.
Okay, so how did the Eighth Circuit actually apply the RFRA test, that whole compelling interest in least restrictive means thing, in light of this deference?
Well, remember, RFRA says the government has to prove they have a compelling interest, a really good reason, for restricting religious freedom. And then they have to show that the action they're taking is the least restrictive way to achieve that goal. So in this case, the Eighth Circuit basically said, okay, we'll assume, for the sake of argument, that the prison's regulations did substantially burden Hamilton's religious exercise. But the key question is whether those burdens were justified under RFRA.
And what did they decide?
Well, the prison laid out their compelling interests. They talked about the safety of both inmates and staff, preventing things like assaults and misconduct. They talked about maintaining security, preventing things like contraband smuggling and gang activity. And then to a lesser extent, they also mentioned the costs associated with accommodating these religious practices.
And the Eighth Circuit bought those arguments.
Well, they did, largely because of that deference principle we talked about. They basically accepted the prison officials' assertion that there weren't any feasible alternatives that would address their security concerns without creating too much risk. You know, they didn't have to completely disprove every single possible alternative, just show that their chosen methods were reasonably related to their compelling interests, which the court seemed to believe they did.
Interesting. But I understand there was also a dissenting opinion in this case, which means that at least one of the judges on the Eighth Circuit panel didn't agree with the majority opinion. And I've heard that this dissenting opinion raised some really fundamental questions, not just about the specifics of Hamilton's case, but about RFRA itself.
Yeah, that's right. Judge McMillian, who is one of the judges on the panel, he wrote this really powerful dissent that went beyond just the facts of Hamilton's situation and actually challenged the constitutionality of RFRA itself.
Whoa, hold on. He's saying that RFRA, the law that Hamilton's whole case is based on, is unconstitutional.
Yeah, that was his argument. His main point was that Congress, when they passed RFRA, had overstepped their bounds and tried to redefine the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment in a way that the Supreme Court had previously rejected.
Okay. I mean, a little more explanation on that one. What was the problem with how Congress defined religious freedom, according to Judge McMillian?
So Judge McMillian's argument was rooted in the idea of the separation of powers. You know, our government is set up with these different branches, the legislative, executive, and judicial, and each branch has its own specific roles and responsibilities. And Judge McMillian's view was that Congress had basically stepped on the toes of the judicial branch, specifically the Supreme Court, by trying to dictate how the Constitution should be interpreted. He argued that interpreting the Constitution is the primary job of the judiciary, ultimately the Supreme Court. And by passing RFRA, which basically imposed this strict scrutiny-like standard for religious freedom claims, even in areas where the Supreme Court had established a different standard, he felt that Congress was essentially trying to tell the courts how to do their job.
So in his view, Congress was overreaching by trying to set a higher bar for protecting religious freedom than what the Supreme Court had already laid out.
Exactly. He saw it as a violation of this fundamental principle of separation of powers that is so central to our system of government. He felt Congress was trying to exert too much control over the courts and over the interpretation of a constitutional right.
So it sounds like Judge McMillian was raising some really serious concerns about RFRA and its implications for the balance of power within our government. And as I understand it, his concerns weren't just theoretical. They actually foreshadowed a later Supreme Court case that really shook things up in this area of law.
Oh, absolutely. Judge McMillian's dissent in Hamilton v. Schreau was kind of a preview of what was to come in the Supreme Court's decision in City of Bourne v. Flores a few years later. In that case, the Supreme Court actually struck down RFRA as it applied to state and local governments.
Wow. So RFRA was basically declared unconstitutional.
Well, not entirely. It still applies to the federal government, which includes federal prisons. But the Supreme Court essentially agreed with Judge McMillian's underlying concern that Congress couldn't use its powers to redefine the substance of constitutional rights in a way that contradicted the Supreme Court's interpretation.
So this one case about a Native American inmate in Missouri ended up having some really huge implications for the whole legal landscape surrounding religious freedom in America.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing how these things can snowball, right?
Totally. So taking a step back and looking at the big picture, what are the main takeaways from Hamilton v. Schreiro for someone trying to understand this area of law? What are the key lessons?
Well, I think one of the biggest things this case highlights is just how tricky it can be to balance the protection of religious freedom with the need for institutional security, especially in a setting like a prison. It's this constant tension, and there aren't always easy answers.
And even though RFRA is still a really powerful tool for protecting religious freedom, Hamilton v. Schreiro shows us that it's not a slam dunk, especially when you're dealing with prisons.
Right. The courts are often very, very hesitant to second-guess the decisions of prison officials when it comes to security matters. So even if RFRA sets a high bar, that deference to prison administrators can sometimes tip the scales in their favor.
So it's this constant push and pull between individual rights and the needs of the institution. And in this case, the Eighth Circuit ultimately came down on the side of the prison.
Exactly. And I think Judge McMillian's dissent serves as this crucial reminder that the fight for religious freedom isn't just about specific cases. It's also about these broader questions of government power and how we interpret the Constitution.
Absolutely. So to kind of wrap things up, what's the core tension that Hamilton v. Schreiro really brings to light for us?
I think it boils down to the ongoing struggle to balance individual rights, specifically religious freedom in this case, with the legitimate needs for safety and order, especially in a challenging environment like a prison.
And the Eighth Circuit's decision really emphasizes just how much weight the courts give to the expertise of prison officials when it comes to security. They really seem to be saying that they'll generally defer to the prison's judgment on those matters.
Yeah, that's definitely a fair reading. And that deference, that willingness to trust the prison's assessment, is a major factor in why Hamilton ultimately lost his case.
So given all the complexities we've talked about, the unique challenges of prison administration, the legal battles over religious freedom, the separation of powers issues, it really makes you wonder, you know, how should courts best handle these kinds of cases? Where do you draw the line between protecting individual rights and ensuring that prisons can operate safely and effectively? And with RFRA being limited in its scope after City of Bourne v. Flores, you know, how does that change things? How do those limitations affect how these cases play out today? That's something for everyone listening to think about. You know, there's no easy answer, but it's a really, really important question.
Absolutely. It's a question that goes to the heart of what it means to live in a free society. And I think Hamilton v. Schreiro is a great example of how those ideals can sometimes clash with the practical realities of running a prison system. It's a fascinating case, and I'm glad we had the chance to dig into it today.
Me too. Really appreciate you taking the time to break it all down.
My pleasure. Always happy to talk about these important legal issues.